Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of WNYC Studios and the New Yorker.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. As a rapper, Riz Ahmed has released a number of critically acclaimed albums, and he was featured on the Hamilton mixtape, which topped the Billboard 200.
Immigrants, we get the job done.
AOA, immigrants, we don't like that. Nah, they don't play. British Empire strikes back. They're beating us like 808s and hi-hats at our own game of invasion. This ain't Iraq. Who these Fugees? What do they do for me but contribute new...
At the same time, Ahmed has built a remarkable career as an actor. This year, he was nominated for an Oscar for his performance as a heavy metal drummer losing his hearing in the film The Sound of Metal. And now comes a new film, Mogul Mowgli. Ahmed plays a rapper named Zahir, or Zed for short. And like The Sound of Metal, it's about a musical artist who's facing a crisis that could end his career.
Don't make me smash your melon up. Try throwing a shade of melanin. Bonafide though, I'm 7-Up. You're too sweet, I put the lemon in. They put their boots on our ground. I'll put my roots in their ground. I'll put my truth in the sound. I'll spit my truth in this brown. I don't give a fuck about the cash you stack with the crown on your skull. You ain't Basquiat or the Prince of Denmark's. Is Eddie Boy piss on their benchmarks? To white kids wanna be packs. Brown planet is gonna be that. The man frown, panic, and wanted me out, but I'm out. Standing cause I stand out. And where I was standing is gonna be twice.
Riz Ahmed wrote Mogul Mowgli with director Bassam Tariq, and it's his first feature as a screenwriter. This movie is extremely emotional, extremely personal, and an extraordinary performance. And I wonder what the origins of it are for you.
Oh, thank you, first of all. I'm so glad you connected with it. You know, it's weird in a way because part of me feels really proud to hear you say that. And yet another part of me is really squirming and cringing in a way that I don't normally when I realize that someone's seen one of my films. But you saying those nice things about this film means that you've seen it.
I have.
And if you've seen this film, then you've seen maybe a part of me and a part of Bassam Tariq that, you know, we don't normally show, don't normally have the opportunity to show or aren't invited to. And in a way, that was the kind of inspiring idea behind the film, which is, what's the story that we don't see? What's the movie you never get to direct? What's the character I never get to play? And often in our kind of quest to kind of, you know, break down the doors of a sometimes not very inclusive industry, and in our well-meaning but slightly misguided desire to carry the burdens of representation for our community, we end up kind of trying to represent and try and enter rooms that we don't normally belong in. And what we realized is that the movie he never gets to direct and the character I never get to play is us. And the story we don't get to tell is the story of people like me and people like Bassam. And actually we realized the more radical thing to do is not to try and enter rooms where we may have been unwanted, but actually go home. And actually to not try and represent other people, but to present ourselves. And so it was very much a kind of inward journey. It was very much about holding up a mirror and hoping that in the honesty and the vulnerability of that exercise, that people would just connect emotionally, even if they couldn't necessarily connect to the specificity of the experience. But for those who could connect to that specificity, it would be like, Jesus Christ, I never thought I'd see that on screen.
Well, obviously the film is about a young man who's... from Pakistani British origins, who's an aspiring rapper and who's starting to accumulate some success and is on the brink of a European tour and has a little break and comes home to visit his family for the first time in 2 years in London.
Assalamu alaikum.
And then discovers that he is quite ill and everything goes off the rails.
Now,
I don't want to alarm you, Mr. Anwar, but from the scans we've done, your muscles seem to be weakening.
So what is that? Like a stroke?
It could be a number of things. We need to run some more tests to determine what course of action is best.
Okay, so I can stop by in a couple of weeks
and get those done. It's got to be, I'm guessing here, is that this is a story that you were carrying around for quite a while.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a good guess. It's one of those ideas that you just keep scribbling away at in a notebook somewhere and your iPhone notes somewhere, and you're never sure if you could ever kind of structure it into a story, if you can get it to cohere as anything other than just kind of therapy for yourself. And then you meet someone like Bassam Tariq. He's this kind of uncanny mirror image in terms of his own background, working class, Pakistani-American.
This is your director.
Exactly, yeah, co-writer and director. And we were kind of able to be mirrors for each other to help organize and structure these thoughts and shape them into a story, drawing from our own experience and the experiences of those around us. So, yeah, in many ways, I mean, this is a story I've been kind of carrying with me my whole life. It's, I don't know, there's something kind of very liberating about making a movie that kind of satirizes and deconstructs your sense of who you are, you know, a public idea of who you are.
Both as a rapper, musician, and also as an actor, you've had tremendous success. You're still in your 30s. You've played a lot of roles, and they range between The Night Of, a remarkable performance, to being in a Star Wars film. How did you feel that your experience, your world, was not being represented quite yet?
Well, it's interesting because, you know, I kind of feel that I've had to be a shapeshifter my whole life. You know, I grew up very much code switching between different worlds from a, as I said, working class Pakistani, you know, household to a kind of predominantly white upper class private school, and then kind of skipping class to hang out with my friends from my neighborhood, which was its own kind of hybrid kind of street culture. And so I was acting from a young age, and kind of what I was taught from a young age implicitly by the world, and I think what the industry also taught me was, you know, shape-shifting will help you get by, but the one thing you can't be is yourself, your messy, contradictory self that is a bit British, but is a bit Pakistani, and is a bit posh, but is a bit street, and is a bit of an actor, but also a bit of a rapper. That all these worlds that you kind of straddle, they all kind of look down at each other or frown at each other, that you're kind of straddling this fault line, and so you better shape-shift. You know, you shouldn't enter any room with all of yourself. You need to leave a part of yourself at the door. And so that, I think, also was reflected often in the kind of roles that I'd play. I felt that, you know, I had to develop quite a wide range in terms of, you know, the roles I had to play because I didn't quite fit a mold. And I think I got to a point after having done a couple of bigger studio movies like Jason Bourne and Star Wars and Venom, where I realized, hey, you know what? Actually, the way to the next step really isn't kind of putting on intricately made masks for others. It's actually about taking the mask off. I've often been driven by this idea of stretching culture. And yeah, sure, part of stretching culture means having someone like me in a Star Wars movie. But I kind of realized that actually, perhaps the thing that doesn't exist in culture is a portrait of a character like this, like me, like Bassam.
It's so interesting. In fiction, you see this genre called autofiction, which is, you know, sort of heavily drawing off the writer's life so that it's a combination of an essay and a dramatic novel, like in the conventional sense. And I wonder if it, when you're making a film like this, which is a kind of autofiction, what you choose to take from life, what you choose to leave to the side, and what you choose to embellish. The biggest embellishment, and thank goodness, is that you get so deathly ill here. Why did you decide that this was necessary as a dramatic pivot in this film?
You know, it's strange because you kind of don't choose. You're always under the illusion that you're in control of making a film, but actually the film's always telling you what it is. And so you kind of lay out this mess of ideas, and some of them are just kind of ideas that have come to you in the shower, and some of them are things that happen to you in your life, and some of them are ideas of what you think the film should be or could be, and, you know, you're stealing ideas from other films that you like. And when you kind of lay it out on the table and start talking and start staring at it, it's kind of staring you down, and it tells you what it is. And I wish I could tell you that we kind of decided, you know, we're going to go 30% reality and 30% surreal, and, you know. But the character and the story very much started taking on a life of its own. It started developing its own internal logic. I think part of what kind of got the film to where it is was a desire on Bassam Tariq's part to develop a kind of visual grammar of our own, a visual language of our own. You know, Arthur Jaffa talks about black visual intonation. It's something that Khalil Joseph also talks about, you know, the idea that kind of African-American or black cinema shouldn't just draw from Western Hollywoodian cinema, but it should kind of look at Miles Davis and jazz and black storytelling traditions. And Bassam Tariq and I, very early on in the process, took a tour, a really long guided tour of the Islamic art collection in the Metropolitan Museum in New York. And we said, what's brown visual intonation? You know, what is our cinematic grammar and language? What can house the hybridity of our own experience? And ultimately, it was something that was hybrid in terms of genre. You know, this has elements of horror and comedy and musical and melodrama all wrapped together. And it was also about incorporating the magical into the day-to-day. You know, I think the idea of magical realism, it's almost kind of... it's almost a defunct term, I think, in the South Asian experience and in the Muslim experience, because magic, mythology, spirituality is embedded into our day-to-day. You know, it's kind of hardwired into the goggles through which we see the world. Well, with regards to the autoimmune condition, it's fascinating because as we started researching this, we realized that people who live in diaspora and ethnic minorities have a far higher incidence of autoimmune illnesses than the general population. And there's a few different theories about why that is. You know, one theory is, you know, minority stress theory, which is that as ethnic minorities, the world is constantly implicitly telling you that you're under threat, you're not welcome, so your immune system is in a state of hypervigilance. It's, you know, it can't turn off. There's another theory, which is that, you know, you just kind of don't belong in these societies, that for thousands of years, your ancestors were in a different climate, had a different diet. And so, you know, it's teething problems. It'll take another millennium before your immune system knows how to process this new environment. And then, you know, on the fringes of this, where, you know, kind of around where medicine, well-being and spirituality kind of intersect, there's this idea that actually autoimmune conditions are a kind of identity crisis. That actually it's the body's inability to recognize itself on a molecular level. And we thought it was just a very, very apt metaphor for what Zed's, you know, contending with in the film, which is, who am I? Where am I from? Am I an individual or am I part of a larger whole? And if the latter, can I pick and choose what I inherit and what I throw away, what I pass on and what I don't? So to me, it was this identity crisis played out on a biological, molecular level, and a way of making that conflict tangible.
You talk about being unwelcome. If you know just a teeny bit about your life and career, in other words, from a resume point, if you think, well, it's quite welcome. Here's this guy. He goes to Oxford and has extraordinary roles in the movies and a music career that's quite extraordinary. Just had an album, The Long Goodbye, which we can talk about in a second. That's one kind of welcome, but in an institution, for example, like Oxford, how was the unwelcome, how did that play out in your life, and how does that inform a piece of art like the film you've just done?
You know, it's interesting you should say this, because I kind of feel like the barriers to achieving those things is exactly what spurs me on to kind of push harder and go harder. So, you know, at Oxford University, for example, you know, that's where I started putting on club nights and really was able to kind of hone some of my craft as an MC. It also, you know, provided income, frankly, for me to kind of stay on there. But I only put that club night on because I was told very explicitly by people as soon as I got there that I didn't belong there. You know, I remember the first person I met at Oxford, I knocked on their door to see if I could borrow their phone charger. And, you know, I could tell it was going to be a pretty posh place, a lot of people in bowler hats and bow ties knocking around. And I asked, like, you know, I'm terribly sorry, I wonder if I could please borrow your phone charger. And she just laughed and said, oh my God, you remind me so much of Ali G, it's unbelievable. And that was the first person I met. So I was like, all right, here it is.
Off to the races.
Yeah, first party I went to, a couple of people in, you know, coattails telling me, look, you must admit, I mean, the British Raj, the Empire, it did do a lot of good for India. I was like, hello, my name, you know, we haven't even got to introductions. You know, it was wild in its own way. And, you know, there have been a lot of barriers, a lot of obstacles in a way, whether it's facing violent racism in my own neighborhood growing up to, you know, institutionalized racism, at my private school that I was lucky enough to get a scholarship to, and Oxford that I was lucky enough to get to. And yes, there's this narrative of like gratitude and luck and good luck, but there's also, just beneath the surface, there's the narrative of people trying to stop you at every turn and having to fight to get to the next stage. And that continued very much in the world of film.
They will ask you where you're from. Now, where are you really from? The question seems simple, but the answer's kind of long. I don't know what to say because anything I say is wrong. Britain's where I'm born, and I love a cup of tea and that. But tea ain't from Britain, it's from where my DNA is at. But where my genes are from, people don't really MC and that. Well, like in NYC, that's where I start.
You know, in Mogul Mowgli, something that's interesting, I think, about it is that it's not about the obstacles or grievances from outside. It's about the obstacles within, the internalized self-hate and the gravitational pull of your roots that on the one hand have kind of fed your creative life and nurtured you and allowed you to do what you do, but on the other hand are always threatening to just pull you down and drag you back into that soil that on some level you've always wanted to escape. So that push and pull between inspiration and obstacle is something that I'm very interested in. It's, you know, been a feature of my own life, and it features very much in the film.
Riz, I can't help asking you, we are talking a couple of days after the United States and so many other countries left Afghanistan after 20 years, and it's the anniversary of 9/11 very soon. How are you thinking about that right now?
What a crazy 20 years. What a kind of bizarre and devastating collective insanity that kind of gripped the planet, gripped the West, that forced the East to kind of define itself, you know, in opposition to the war on terror. Just the whole thing, it kind of feel like we're all emerging out of this collective trauma. And 20 years in, I kind of look back at my own life. You know, I'm 38. I was 18 when 9/11 happened. And it's kind of defined, you know, our lives. It's certainly defined a lot of my career. When I look back and look at my resume, I mean, like, probably half of my output is a response in some way, directly or indirectly, to this post 9/11 era that we're all living under. You know, an attempt to add nuance, complexity, humanity, some kind of reaction to this cloud that we've all lived under. And really the way I'm thinking about it now is, I hope, honestly, it's just the end of an era. And I say that with no nostalgia.
Riz Ahmed, thank you so much. Wonderful to talk to
you. Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Riz Ahmed's new film is called Mogul Mowgli, co-written and directed by Bassam Tariq. It's just out in theaters now. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. More to come.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
I'm Ira Flatow, host of Science Friday. For over 30 years, our team has been reporting high-quality news about science, technology, and medicine. News you won't get anywhere else. And now that political news is 24/7, our audience is turning to us to know about the really important stuff in their lives. Cancer, climate change, genetic engineering, childhood diseases. Our sponsors know the value of science and health news. For more sponsorship information, visit sponsorship.wnyc.org.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. Over the last couple of months, more than 35 million American families received checks in the mail from the federal government, payments for the child tax credit. The idea of a family tax credit is not new. What's new is this. The money doesn't show up once a year at tax time. Instead, the government gives some of it in advance in predictable monthly payments. And this can make a very big difference in people's lives. The shift in policy owes a great deal to Senator Michael Bennett, a Democrat from Colorado. Bennett is now pushing to make the changes become permanent. Senator, you ran for president in 2020 largely on this issue, and let's just say that it didn't propel you to the top of the heap, and now here we are, here we are, and it's this issue, not Medicare for All, which has become one of the huge signature issues on which Joe Biden really is trying to project himself as the second coming of FDR. It's surprising.
Well, what's surprising is that you noticed that I ran for president. Almost nobody did. Almost nobody did. But you're right. I ran for president on the idea that we could cut childhood poverty nearly in half with some changes to the child tax credit. And I believed that, I actually believed during that campaign that I was right where the American people were on a number of issues, including this issue, and that this issue, for example, would be transformational and also politically doable in a way that Medicare for All, just to take that as an example, would not be. And here we are fighting to try to make it permanent or extended.
The payments are expected to halve child poverty this year. In what ways?
Well, it's going to, that's just the number of kids that are going to be lifted out of poverty. I was with the two tribes in Colorado this weekend, and the percentage of Native American kids that are going to be lifted out of poverty is roughly 60%. So a little additional support of $250 or $300 a month is going to mean people are going to be able to afford a few hours of child care that they can't afford now. They're going to be able to fix a car when it breaks, so they're going to be able to get to their second job. I mean, this is going to be really useful to the 90% of American children whose families are receiving this tax credit.
But here's what one Democrat said in the mid-90s about this entire situation. The culture of dependence must be replaced with the culture of self-sufficiency and personal responsibility. That's Senator Joe Biden of Delaware, speaking in the mid-90s. Yeah. What happened?
Well, I think he probably still believes in self-sufficiency. I do, and the countries that have the child, you know, something like the child tax credit, child allowance, as it's called in many countries around the world, actually have higher workforce participation rates than the United States of America. We have made it extremely hard for people to be poor and to work and to hold on to jobs, whether because, you know, because we don't have something like the child allowance, because we don't have paid family leave. And I think there's a sort of a dawning realization that having a decent safety net is important if you want people to be able to work and stay at work. So I'm not sure there is a conflict.
But why say that you're for self-sufficiency? Not everybody can depend on themselves and their own capabilities. Some people are sick. Some people are poorly educated and can't get a leg up in a new kind of economy. What's so hard about saying for the Democratic Party or anybody that what the shift is toward a social democracy, more and more like we see in Europe? I'm not saying it's necessarily going to be achieved. We know the political dynamics, but do the politics demand that you say, I'm for self-sufficiency, and at the same time work for the kind of programs that you are?
No, I don't think the politics demand it. I think that it's a reality in my, you know, state. People that want to work, you know, have a hard time working because they don't have child care, they don't have health care, they don't have a reliable place to put their kid. And these are the challenges that they're confronting. I think they want to work. I think they want to provide for their family. And I take your point. There's some people that can't work, and we need to make sure that we're doing what we can to keep them out of poverty.
But Senator, we hear from economists that automation and artificial intelligence will lead to millions of job losses in the coming years. In factories, construction, transportation, service industries, all over the place. And unlike the pandemic, those losses are probably going to be permanent. So let's talk about the idea of universal basic income, UBI. The child tax credit you've championed is not UBI, but isn't UBI a logical next step if you want to build a more secure safety net in this country?
Well, my focus today, David, is very much on extending the child tax credit. I think that's what's in front of us right now. It would be terrible if this thing comes to an end at the end of this year. And so we're fighting to make sure that we extend it. And then I think there'll be opportunity to look at other things. There's no question that our economy is transformed. And so the question for us is, how do we put in place a robust safety net that allows people to contribute to the economy?
Just to be clear, is a UBI, universal basic income proposal, just too radical somehow for this open discussion in the Senate as it stands now?
I think it would, you know, roughly cost $4 trillion a year, which is what we're spending today, you know, in our entire federal government. And I think when you start to do that math, it becomes very hard to get your head around that kind of transformation. I don't think it's because it's radical. I think it's because, you know, it hasn't been socialized, to use that word, with the American people. So there's a lot of stuff kind of in between that I think we should be pursuing as an agenda that's more likely to get across the finish line. And I'm interested in getting stuff done, you know, before I'm dead. That's sort of my policy. And that's why I've been working on the child tax credit.
Senator Bennett, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Michael Bennett of Colorado. He's been in the Senate since 2009. Congressional Democrats are looking to pass the child tax credit extension through reconciliation. Now, the child tax credit, as Senator Bennett is quick to note, is not universal basic income. But our economics correspondent, Sheila Kolhatkar, sees it as a sort of UBI test drive.
Well, anytime you have people receiving cash from the government on a regular basis, it starts to feel a little bit like a UBI payment.
Sheila has been covering the debate on UBI for years, particularly in regards to job losses through automation. And up until recently, UBI felt pretty theoretical.
But once the pandemic hit and the economy essentially collapsed, the government passed a series of rescue bills and ended up sending out stimulus checks to people, and they expanded unemployment benefits. So suddenly you had millions of people getting money every month, and they weren't even working.
All those federal measures did something remarkable. We just had the biggest reduction in poverty in our history.
The assistance cut poverty in the U.S. by 45% across all racial and ethnic lines. That's 20 million people who were lifted out of poverty during a pandemic. It was one of the greatest reductions in poverty we've ever seen in the United States. It's astonishing.
Sheila Kolhatkar sat down recently with two thinkers who have very different views on universal basic income. Michael Strain is the director of economic policy studies at the American Enterprise Institute, and Amy Castro is a professor at the University of Pennsylvania. Castro is heading up the Stockton experiment, which is a very small-scale UBI project that gives 125 randomly chosen people in Stockton, California, $500 every month.
I wanted to ask you, Amy, quickly about, you've had some preliminary results come in from that experiment. What has been the most surprising thing that you have learned from that project?
Only one. I only get one.
Or three. Three surprises.
three things I'll say. The first thing that I think is probably, most of interest to people is the changes that we saw in anxiety and depression. So at the beginning of the experiment, those who are in the treatment group and those who are in the comparison or the control group were all given repeated measures, something called the Kessler 10. This is a standard scale that we use. Most people have probably taken it at the doctor's office. And it measures essentially your likelihood of whether or not you're well. And what we saw was after 1 year of payments, those who were in the treatment group moved from likely to have a mental health disorder to likely to be well. That's both compared to themselves and compared to the comparison group. We did not see the same changes in the control group. And so we saw that simply by giving people cash and stabilizing their incomes, and it wasn't a lot of money, it was only $500 a month, not enough to live off of per se, we saw drastic changes in health and well-being that were really quite extraordinary. The second thing was we saw an increase in full-time employment. So among those who were receiving the money, the treatment group, only 28% could claim full-time employment at the start of the experiment. Fast forward 1 year later, and that amount actually jumped up. And it's interesting because we went back and we followed people to figure out how did those changes take place. And it really was the fact that people could use that $500 as a floor, right, to jump off of and take a risk and look for another job. So I wasn't necessarily surprised by that. We kind of expected to see something along those lines. What I was surprised by was how quickly they were able to do so.
Michael, you wrote a couple of years ago in an op-ed about how you were, you weren't crazy about the universal basic income idea because people might make irresponsible decisions with that money and still not have enough to eat or buy their prescription drugs at the end of the month. And you wrote that a little paternalism in how government aid is distributed is a good thing. So could you just talk a bit about what that means? What did you mean by paternalism being good?
Briefly, let me just say that I think Amy's work on this has been so important and really groundbreaking, and she's really a leader in helping to understand the answers to many of these questions. I think, one reason to have a food stamp program or a Section 8 housing program and not just cash is to make sure that parents are spending the government aid on food and housing rather than on vacations. And so, As a taxpayer, I am eager to pay income taxes to make sure that hungry people have enough food to eat, and to make sure that people who need shelter have adequate shelter. I am not eager to pay taxes so that somebody can buy drugs or buy alcohol or go to Vegas and
I just have to ask though, what evidence is there that actually occurs, like actual empirical data?
That
I mean, I'm sure there's a few, but like
yeah, there's evidence from the Supplemental Security Income from the SSI program for sure. But this is kind of an evidence-free topic. We have done some relatively small dollar universal income programs, and there are things that we can learn from those. But if you're talking about giving households thousands of dollars with no strings attached over a prolonged period of time, that's not something we have a lot of evidence on, you know, because that's so far outside the base of policy experience.
Yeah, I totally agree with you. Is it sort of there's so much that we don't know in terms of the data, but you know what we do know, you know, based on the data, is that the way that we've been doing things, you know, is not working. Right? It's that it's simply not. And so for me, the idea of taking unconditional cash off the table, off of fear that people are going to suddenly become a drug addict, seems kind of ridiculous. But it's sort of like which do we want to risk? Do we want to risk locking people out of financial stability, economic mobility, and locking them out of being able to be independent with their own funds, you know, at the expense of making sure that someone doesn't spend cash on cigarettes? Like, that just, to me, feels like a risk I'm willing to take, right? Is that it makes far more sense to make sure that we're stabilizing U.S. households with the understanding that, like, well, some people spend it in a way that we'd rather them not. Yeah, sure, of course they will. But by the same token, it's interesting to me that we apply different rules to different sectors of the economy, right? So we think about sort of a little paternalism, I think was the phrase, will go a long way. It's interesting because we don't tend to apply, we meaning, you know, us as a country, not you specifically, Michael, we don't tend to apply that logic to the wealthy. Right? So we don't say a little paternalism would go a long way if we would tell Jeff Bezos what to do with his windfall. Or, right? We don't do that. We apply rules of how people can and cannot spend cash and use resources at the bottom end of the income ladder, not the top.
Yeah. I mean, the obvious difference, of course, is that people who have very high incomes aren't receiving other people's money through the tax and transfer system to finance aspects of their lives, and that's not true at the bottom end. I'm not opposed.
We're gonna have another show to discuss that question: is whether the wealthy receive taxpayer benefits. But let's assume that they don't for the rest of your answer.
Well, sorry. Certainly Go Jeff ahead. Bezos is contributing much more in income
Jeff
taxes.
Jeff Bezos takes
that
a
he's
lot
taking,
from the state
out of the system. Yeah. I'm not opposed to cash. I think we have some really excellent programs that do offer cash to low-income households. The Earned Income Tax Credit, for example, is an earning subsidy. But I think we have to be very thoughtful about the amount of cash and about the kind of balance in the system between in-kind transfers like Section 8 housing vouchers, like food stamps, like Medicaid, and simply writing people checks.
Amy, how do you think about the challenge of financing a national program like this?
This is why, you know, I have the, like, I can say this because I'm not stuck in politics. I'm a scientist, right? Is that this is why we need data, right? Sort of actually figuring out how much it really would cost and where that money would come from and making sure that we're designing smart proposals. And so to me, there's two leading ways that have been proposed, you know, from my perspective as to how we would actually fund this. You know, one would be a carbon tax. You know, I'd point to my colleague, Dr. Ioana Marinescu's work on that. She really has done, the lion's share of research on that topic. And the second would be a data tax. So not meaning taxing Americans for their data and their use of the internet, but really taxing companies that benefit right now tax-free from all the cookies that we leave all over the web. So we all use things like Facebook, Snapchat, Instagram, choose your thing, right, for free. You know, in air quotes, for free, right? But in reality, that data that you're spreading all over the internet is being sold back to you in the form of ad revenue, right? So that's another way that we can think about funding these sorts of things.
Michael, how do you think about this question of the cost of such a program if we were to expand it to apply to, you know, the entire country or a larger segment of the population? Is it just too expensive to even consider?
Yes, I think it's too expensive to even consider. Now, if you wanted to adopt, you know, kind of a more libertarian approach to this and you wanted to say, okay, well, you know, we should have a universal basic income, but we should phase out some existing safety net programs and replace it with cash. You know, then, you know, I think the financial aspect of this becomes much more viable politically. But I think you run into, you know, quite a bit of opposition, you know, because you're proposing eliminating big portions of the safety net.
Amy, I'm going to call on you since you're moving your head.
Yeah. So, I mean, to me, you know, as somebody who works with this data and is running a lot of these experiments, the big con with the approach of UBI as it was laid out in the Yang plan was that it advocated for eliminating the safety net. And the math just doesn't work, right? So if you get $1,000 a month, it's not going to make up for the fact that you may or may not have a Section 8 voucher. It's not going to cover Medicaid. It's not going to cover all those other things. Now, does that mean that the safety net as it is working well? No, it doesn't. It needs to be reformed. There's inefficiencies all over the place that unconditional cash can help us address. But simply giving people $1,000 a month is going to introduce new forms of inequality, not erase old ones.
The Biden administration's child tax credit changes, which now is going to guarantee many families $300 per month per child for a number of months. So this is obviously not the same. Well, it has some similarities to universal cash payments because, yes, it's going to many, many people, maybe not everyone, but almost everyone, including people who may not need it. Do you think that this is something that the policymakers should consider continuing, and in which case it would become a bit more similar to a universal sort of regular cash transfer system?
Well, I think we, you know, we have it for the year. And the question is whether or not Congress is going to extend it for five more years, which is what the president wants. But I would not continue the program as it's designed for households that really are upper income. I think there are a lot better uses of billions and billions and billions of dollars than writing checks to households that have incomes above $250,000. And, you know, one of those better uses is doing more to fight poverty among kids.
So you'd take the universal out of universal basic income.
I would.
Sounds like
I would take the universal and the basic out of universal basic income.
Oh, okay. Just income. I like it. Kind of snappy.
The New Yorker's Sheila Cole Hatkar. She spoke with Michael Strain of the American Enterprise Institute and Amy Castro of the University of Pennsylvania. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. Stick around.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. As we continue looking at the American withdrawal from Afghanistan and the long shadow of a 20-year war, The New Yorker's longtime contributor, Robin Wright, joins us on our podcast, Politics and More. She'll join editor Dorothy Wickenden to talk about the reemergence of ISIS. That's on Politics and More, a podcast from The New Yorker. Now, to wrap things up this week, I'm joined now by my friend and colleague, Liz Maines Amenzadeh, The New Yorker's puzzles and games editor. Hey, Liz.
Hey, David.
A couple of weeks ago, you may well remember, we played a round of Name Drop, our new quiz, and I frankly had a humiliating loss to our colleague, Nomi Fry. Not that I'm going to hold a grudge, but I'm out of the hot seat now because two of our listeners are joining us to play Name Drop today, Steve Westhoff and Leonice Moses. So welcome and thanks for coming to you both.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
Thanks for doing this. You guys are courageous.
David kind of helped us out with the Janet Jackson.
Yeah, very low bar.
You know, it's, I won't be so embarrassed.
Exactly.
I'm still having, you know, post-traumatic stress syndrome from the last time we played this game, but we're going to go forward. Liz is going to read out a series of clues describing a notable personality in either history or in contemporary times. And when you know it, you're going to say, I got it. Don't say your answer. Say, I got it, and write it down on a piece of paper. Then put your pen down or your pencil, whatever you're writing with. Liz, you ready?
Okay, should we do this?
Ready.
Yes.
Round one. This is for 6 points. As part of a 1998 April Fool's Day segment on NPR, I announced my plan to become an accordion player.
That's a terrible trick to play on anyone.
Five okay. points. I can be heard on the soundtracks of Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon and Master and Commander, The Far Side of the World.
Yep, keep going.
Since 2006, I've served as a United Nations Messenger of Peace, a title I currently share with Jane Goodall, Stevie Wonder, and 10 others.
You're killing me here, Liz. You're killing me.
I think I picked exceptionally hard quizzes.
I think you picked the unbelievably
hard
ones. You did.
Just wanted to make it dramatic. 3 points. In 1999, after playing at Carnegie Hall, I accidentally left my $2.5 million instrument in the trunk of a cab. David is pantomiming a clue here.
I think I know who it is. I can give it a guess.
Leonice, are you committing? Not committing.
No.
Okay. Go ahead, keep going.
Okay, for two. At age 7, on the recommendation of Pablo Casals, a virtuoso of my instrument, I performed at a televised benefit attended by Presidents Kennedy and Eisenhower. Okay, and here's the last clue. I've recorded more than 100 albums, received 18 Grammy Awards, and recently toured the world performing Bach's 6 solo cello suites on 6 continents.
Go ahead, Steve.
Go ahead, Steve.
Yeah.
I'll guess Yo-Yo Ma.
You got it.
You guessed right.
All right.
I feel like I should be a little older to play this.
Oh, a shot. A shot. That's a shot across the bow, Liz. Okay. Now, as somebody who failed miserably, not that I bring it up very often in conversation, only once every 5 minutes, who failed miserably at this game with my colleague last week, how are you guys feeling? Are you doing all right?
No. No, I feel like I need a rematch.
You need a rematch?
I don't lose.
I think this is luck as much as anything else right now, really.
All right, here we go. So the next one, go ahead, Liz.
Round two for 6 points. Though I'm not primarily known as an actor, my screen credits include a troubled teen on As the World Turns and an elevator operator in the Steven Soderbergh film King of the Hill. For five, my debut solo album, which opens with a ringing school bell, features interludes in which an educator, Roz Baraka, who later became the mayor of Newark, talks with students about the nature of love. All right, for 4 points. That 1998 album, much of which was recorded at Bob Marley's Tough Gong Studio in Kingston, Jamaica, was the first hip-hop record to win the Grammy for Album of the Year.
I can tell that you're getting the itch. I can see Leonice, she's closing in on it. I can see it.
Okay. I sampled the Wu-Tang Clan's Can It All Be So Simple in my song X Factor, which in turn was sampled in both Drake's Nice For What and Cardi B's
I got it.
Has it for three.
A giant smile is cutting across the face of Lainey's, thank God. And how about you, Steve? Are you in yet?
I thought I had it with the 98 album, and no, I may not.
All right, keep going.
Okay, here's for two. I was a founding member of the Fugees, along with Wyclef Jean and Praz Michel, and I sang lead vocals on Killing Me Softly, our cover of a Roberta Flack hit.
Okay, I did have it.
Okay, Steve's got it for two. And here's for one. My only solo studio album to date, which is titled The Miseducation of Me, has sold sold more than 10 million copies and features the number one single, Doo-Wop That Thing.
Lainey, do us the honors.
Lauryn Hill.
There it is.
You got
Lauryn
it.
Hill. Lauryn Hill. Steve, did you get Lauryn Hill?
Yes.
Okay. So looking at the scorecard, Liz, what have we got?
It's a close one, but Steve eked it out 5-3.
Congratulations, Steve. Now, Leonis, you okay? You hanging in there?
It's fine. I wanted to come out on top far beyond Steve, like way higher.
Yeah. And Steve, how about you?
I feel great about it. I was worried about getting shut out. I did not come here to win necessarily.
I did.
Exactly. A different view to competition. It's fair enough. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You can play Name Drop at NewYorker.com. There's a new quiz every weekday. And if you want to play on the air with us, send an email to NewYorkerRadio@WNYC.org. Make your subject line Name Drop. Thank you, Leonis Moses and Steve Westhoff. And thanks to Liz Maines Amenzadeh, our puzzles editor. That's the New Yorker Radio Hour for now. Thanks for listening. See you next time.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Merrill Garbus of Tune Yards, with additional music by Alexis Quadrado. This episode was produced by Alex Barron, Emily Botine, Ave Carrillo, Rhiannon Corby, Kalalia, David Krasnow, Gofen Mputubwele, Louis Mitchell, Michelle Moses, and Stephen Valentino.
And we had additional help from Harrison Keithline.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.